Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today on episode 181, we have a listener-inspired episode. One graduating fellow asked, how should I arrange my clinics to maximize efficiency? Well, we brought in three retina specialists in practice to try and answer that question. I'm joined now by Dr. Amy Scheffler, Dr. Chirag Shah, and Dr. Nathan Steinle for a panel discussion. Remember that a list of financial disclosures will be attached in the episode description. Also remember that you can claim CME via the AAO website for select episodes. Simply click on the link in the episode description to claim your credits. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now honored to be joined by three retina specialists for this panel on practice management and really clinic logistics. We're going to work in alphabetical order. I made my job very hard unintentionally by picking people all with the letter S, so I'm going to test my spelling bee skills. First in alphabetical order, Dr. Amy Scheffler from Retina Consultants of Houston. She's also an associate professor at both Cornell and University of Texas at Houston and is a vitreoretinal surgeon and ocular oncologist. Dr. Scheffler, Amy, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Jay.
Next in alphabetical order, Dr. Chirag Shah, who is a vitreoretinal surgeon and partner at Ophthalmic Consultants of Boston. In addition, he's the fellowship director in the joint fellowship there, and also an assistant professor at Tufts University and a lecturer at Harvard University. Chirag, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Jay, for having me. I might be cutting in and out just because I'm running a little bit behind in clinic, but I'll get right back on the call.
Well, for the listeners, we're recording this at 9:30 p.m. Eastern to coordinate across three time zones, and I think that's highly unlikely, but thanks, Chirag. And then the easy low-hanging fruit, because if anyone's out there and hears Scheffler, Shah, and Sridhar and realizes those three are the Sha sound three different spellings, we've got Dr. Nathan Steinle joining us all the way from California, from California Retina Consultants based in Santa Barbara. Nathan, thanks for being here.
Hey, it's an honor. Thank you so much.
So this was a panel that was requested by a listener who was a fellowship graduate, and I think it's very helpful, not just for people who graduated, but think people like me who want to know how to make their clinic flow better. And again, we're talking about ideal situations. I think one of the disclaimers everyone who's coming on the panel said is no one's clinic runs perfectly. There's always things they can do better. But just to start, so and I'm open. Amy, I'll ask you first of all, and you can all kind of identify your practice type when you start as well. How do you schedule patients? Like, what's your general philosophy for scheduling patients to avoid inefficiency or long patient wait times, which is really one of the things that is factored into now how physicians are graded and kind of assessed by patients?
Right. It's a great question, Jay. So I think it's worth repeating your disclaimer, which is that my clinic most definitely does not run perfectly. So I don't want to claim to be the world's expert on this, but I would say a couple of general guiding principles that we started doing in my clinic and in my practice and that are kind of an ongoing project, so to speak, are the following. One is that I'm a lot more mindful in the past than I used to be about scheduling lasers, which in some ways have become less and less frequent, right, for many of us, at the very beginning of the day or the very end of the day. I pretty much never do them in the middle of the day anymore, and that's helped a lot. The other thing is we have templates, of course, I'm sure as everyone does, that are pretty mindful about spreading new patients out throughout the day. So you don't have like a clump of three or four or five in a row, which creates kind of a long roadblock. And then the third kind of guiding principle I would say is that we've tried it different ways in my practice in terms of a lunch break. I never really actually take a lunch break, but we've found that what works the best is to actually at least have a gap in the middle of the day that kind of gives you a chance to catch up, regardless of whether you actually spend that time actually taking a break. But it just sort of gives you an opportunity to finish up the morning and kind of reset so you're not behind when you start the afternoon. So I'd say those are the kind of the three major interventions that have been helpful.
Chirag, Amy referenced lasers. More commonly, we're doing in-office procedures such as injections. Injections and lasers are often not emergencies, so you may have some flexibility in terms of how you're scheduling, unless it's a tear or a patient with neovascular glaucoma that needs urgent anti-VEGF, for the most part, there's some flexibility there. What do you do in terms of your in-office procedures, and what other sort of principles, building on what Amy said, do you use to maximize your clinic efficiency?
Everything that Amy says said, I strive to do. I don't necessarily do it very well, but I think all those pearls are very important. In terms of injections and lasers, you know, certainly we're doing fewer and fewer lasers these days. I tend to just, a lot of my lasers end up being tears or something more urgent, and oftentimes my patient population just wants to get it done right then. So I will just integrate the laser into my day, but we're only talking, you know, a couple of lasers a day, not that many. Occasionally when a laser can be scheduled, such as a PRP or something along those lines, we'll try to do it first thing in the morning, because usually they can get dilated and get to the laser at 7:30 in the morning before clinic really starts picking up and before I get too far behind. And just try to get it done in the morning. I find that doing lasers at the end of the day are usually the toughest for me, because I end up getting a lot of add-on emergencies at the end of the day. And so to do a scheduled laser at that time is a little bit more challenging. In terms of injections, they just occur throughout the day. So you probably a third to a half of the patients that I see on any given day will be injections patients. And we sort of just book them continuously throughout the day, and then intersperse new patients and consults and post-ops in between. And that tends to be a little bit more fun for me, because it kind of varies it a little bit. And it also kind of, you know, the injection patients tend to be, especially the routine injection patients, tend to be a little bit quicker. And then the new patient or the second opinion patient tends to take a little bit more time. So the time that I spend on a new patient, I'll tend to get back on several injection patients.
You know, Nathan, one of the big principles when people go into practice is the three A's, and one of them is being available. In addition to new patients and procedures, you have to factor in add-on patients sometimes too, depending on your practice location and referring doctors in the area. Again, and you can build more on what Amy and Chirag said as well, but let's add in the complex factor. You have, as a retina specialist, we often have add-on patients. And how do you kind of prioritize those and get it so it doesn't mess up your clinic flow, given that it can be a regularity in a retina practice?
Yeah, Jay's a super good question, and it's something I struggle with every day, because you want to be available, and you want to be there for the referring doctors, but you also have your patients that are in your waiting room waiting to be seen too. So a couple of hints that I would share is, first off, almost all my triage patients or add-on patients, I put at the end of the session. So it's either end of the morning or end of the afternoon. And that way I'm not actually disrupting the patients that have a scheduled visit. And if the triage patient has to wait a little bit longer at the end of the morning or in the afternoon, they never really complain, because they just really happen to be seen that day, because they know that they're kind of being added on to the schedule. So that's number one. And number two, a good hint I would pass along is, if you have an ophthalmologist or an optometrist who's trying to refer a patient, you know, somewhat urgently to you, as long as it's not endophthalmitis, if it's like a retinal tear or possible detachment, something like that, one hint I would share is, try and get the patient's name and number, because that referring doctor just basically wants to get that patient, you know, to leave their office, right? And then you have control then of talking to the patient or having a front desk call the patient and then scheduling exactly when you want that patient to come see you. Sometimes other referring doctors will try and send the patient directly over to see you. And sometimes that's not always the most efficient, because they'll get there, you know, the middle of the busy morning or middle of the busy afternoon. And then that patient's already there with the expectation they're trying to be seen right away. But I like to call the patient myself, and then we have that conversation of what time they should come in and schedule them at the triage at the end of the morning and the afternoon. And one other hint, I appreciate Sher saying that, you know, he kind of works with injection patients throughout the day. And I used to do that, but one thing I kind of have migrated towards is, like, I try to treat these injection patients as my true frequent flyers, the patients who come in, you know, really routinely to see me. I know them really well. I know exactly my treatment plan is for them. So I usually say my first 10 slots in the morning, my first 10 slots in the afternoon, just for injection patients alone. So I know that I can get really quickly through 10 patients morning, 10 patients afternoon, just injection patients, and they're really happy patients. So they know they're not gonna be there very long, and they're, you know, they're not tied up with a lot of diagnostic equipment, using just a quick OCT injection, and they're out the door. So Jay, those are some hints I would share with you.
You know, and before we proceed, I think sometimes it's helpful, and this is not for comparison's sake or bragging rights here, but actually just to give people kind of context and what volumes we're talking about. And I'll start, you know, how many patients are people seeing in a day? So like for me, I'll start in an academic setting, you know, it depends on the clinic day and what my staffing support is, but I'm not going to be as busy as you guys. I'll probably see maybe 50 in a day. And I'd have, and sadly, I don't know the breakdown of new versus established versus injections. and a fairly immature practice compared to some people with maybe more newer patients and less of those frequent injections. And work backwards, Nathan, and then maybe Chirag and Amy, just so the listeners kind of get a context, how many patients are you typically seeing in a regular day?
I usually break it down by half day, so I probably do about 35 and a half day on an average day, and sometimes it's up to 40, so probably between 70 and 80 patients a day. That's pretty routine for me.
How about you, Chirag?
That makes me tired just thinking about that. I see about 60 patients in a day.
And Amy? And Amy is a little different because you do ocular oncology as well, so that we have to factor that in as well to your volumes.
Right. So my clinic is a little weird, and there are a bunch of special considerations that I'm happy to talk about. My days vary, so I see anywhere from 40 to 80, and it depends on the setting. So we have a couple of clinics that that my partners and I rotate at that are primarily retina, and those tend to be the ones that are higher. And then in our in-town kind of very academic clinics where I see much sicker patients and primarily oncology patients, you know, it's more like 40 or 50. So, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, everyone's numbers are kind of in the same range. It's hard. Look, you know, I think we can all acknowledge that in this day and age, it's difficult to make it, the reality is there are only so many minutes in the day, right? It's difficult to see 70 or 80 and have it run perfectly. It's just very difficult, no matter how hard you try. It's often not perfect. And I think one of the things that I've kind of gotten used to is that there's going to be a percentage of patients. I mean, obviously you hope it's not 50%, but some percentage of patients every day who are going to be, you know, anywhere from somewhat to significantly dissatisfied because they feel like they waited too long.
You know, Amy, I'm curious, and I'll ask the whole group, one of the things that I'm sort of insulated in academics, but maybe should be more aware of and something to think about is, you know, you do have staff members that you're paying, and building in a lunch is sometimes part of the employee agreement, and sometimes running late is something that has overhead considerations in terms of costs. I mean, how do your practices work? Are the staff paid per hour? Are they paid overtime past a certain point? Amy, you referenced you take lunch, but if you decide not to take lunch, for example, is that something that could happen within your practice setting?
Yes, that's a great question. It is nice to be insulated from these issues in academics, no question, having been in both settings. It's a nice thing about academics. So I think, you know, in most states, like kind of one of the basic employment laws is that you have to let people eat lunch. And it's kind of a good general principle. So all of our employees are always kind of told to take lunch and asked to take lunch, and they're supposed to clock out for at least a half an hour for lunch. So what we do is we have like a rolling lunch, basically, like kind of in that whole middle section of the day, they take turns going to break room and eating lunch. So it's not like everyone is eating lunch all at once, but everyone gets a chance to eat lunch. I just don't eat lunch, but they do.
Nathan, if you run late, what happens in terms of your clinic staffing?
Yeah, I piggyback on exactly what Amy said. We have a rolling start to our clinics. We have, you know, certain techs get there early, and then we have certain techs, the other techs that are dedicated for late techs. And so we really try and be conscientious about not having overtime. And we try and follow every single employment law as far as breaks and as far as lunches. And so it becomes a little bit difficult. And there's definitely times where I'm kind of solo by the end of the morning or end of the afternoon. And my staff's kind of disappeared. And I know it's not because they don't want to be there, but just because they just, you know, cannot, you know, legally be there anymore. And so, yeah, we do a rolling lunch and a rolling start to the clinic.
Chirag, let's talk about bottlenecks a little bit. And we're always interested in bottlenecks, bottlenecks being the point at which the patient stops flowing through the clinic and gets unhappy in a waiting room, whether it's a dilating room or an imaging room or just waiting to be seen by the doctor. How do you identify these? And one of the big bottlenecks I've seen, at least in my clinics, is which patients get imaging. And sometimes it'll be an established or more likely a new patient who gets seen, gets dilated. Maybe there are a couple patients ahead of them. They end up waiting. They get seen by me. Then they have to go back for imaging. And that always drives me a little crazy. Sometimes you can't predict this, but certain sort of situations, it would have been nice from an efficiency standpoint to have them get their imaging so they're not waiting as long. Do you routinely image all your new patients? Are there ways for you to kind of look, prioritize, and know in advance? Are your technicians trained to kind of know when to get an OCT, for example, on a new patient? And what other sort of bottlenecks do you see in your clinic that tend to, you can look back and say, okay, this is something we could solve?
Those are great questions, Jay. So my techs, for the most part, know when to get an OCT for a new patient. And most of the time, I'll look through the list of patients for today. I'll look at the new patients, and oftentimes I'll get either an email or a phone call or a letter regarding the new patient. It's not uncommon where someone just shows up kind of off the street. And so I'll know if they're being referred for a retinal tear, in which case they don't need any imaging, or if they're being referred for macular degeneration, in which case I'll usually get an OCT. And my techs are pretty good about knowing that as well. And so we try our best that while they're dilating, they're getting their imaging, which is typically either an OCT or nothing. It's not actually very common for me to check fluorescein angiogram so much these days. I rely a lot on the OCT, and we have OCTA as well. But if I know I need, for example, a wide-angle angiogram, for example, in a diabetic, then I'll try to get that all at the same time. So that way they're in the diagnostic area just once, and then they'll, by the time they see me, they have all their data that I can interpret for them. So we do our best. And then for people who are coming back to clinic, we'll try to designate on their note as to what they need the next time. With our injection patients, sometimes if they're coming back just for their fellow eye, or we know that they're just getting a couple, a few injections in a row, we'll do something called straight to inject, where they bypass the technician, they bypass photography, and they just come in for an injection. A lot of people don't like bilateral injections. And in terms of identifying bottlenecks, oftentimes it becomes somewhat obvious after looking at our electronic medical record and seeing where people are kind of hung up. We can kind of extract data from that as well. But really the two spots where I have bottlenecks, where I've noticed bottlenecks, is diagnostics. And then depending on which office I'm in and which techs I'm given that particular day, because I don't always have the same techs, those are the two bottlenecks, either the technicians or photography or both.
Nathan, any other comments you want to make about bottlenecks and just kind of, again, keeping the flow going when you have patients? I mean, like Chirag, are your techs kind of good and trained in terms of knowing when to get imaging on a patient, and so that you don't end up coming and seeing the patient realizing they need a whole bunch of testing?
Yeah, great question. So I think Chirag brought up some really good points. So I always review all my charts when I first get in the morning for my new patient, so I know exactly what imaging I'm going to have for each patient. The second thing is we have separate schedules for the clinic visit, for the OCT visit, and for the FA visit. So every day we have actually three schedules printed out for all the patients, all the OCTs today, and for the FAs, because we weren't doing that a while ago, and then the FAs would sometimes all be clumped together. And so we came up with the idea that we should really schedule the FA too, so that you can kind of spread them out throughout the day. And then one final tip I'll kind of point out is, if you guys ever get a chance, as your listeners, there's a book called Synchrony, S-Y-N-C-H-R-O-N-Y. And it's by Dennis Hahn, H-A-N, who is a guru of efficiency, and he's actually an ophthalmologist. So if you guys get a chance and you want to do some deeper reading into avoiding bottlenecks, one of the topics he talks about is, have you or your staff do these waist walks, where you actually kind of follow the flow of the patient, and you can kind of almost do like a diagram of how many wasted steps were, if the OCTs went out to the hall, and then if the check-ins in a different area. And these patients, at least in my clinic, are moving kind of slow. And so to try to minimize those number of steps, to kind of minimize those bottlenecks. It's a great book to check out.
That's a great tip. Amy, your thoughts on bottlenecks before we talk about the ever-important subject of communication with referring doctors. So in terms of bottlenecks, do you ever kind of do this kind of post-assessment? I think that when you start in practice, you can be a little overwhelmed with everything else you're doing, but this may be something to start considering, at least within the first year or two.
Yeah, for sure. So we've done, so it's a great recommendation to check out Dennis Hahn's work, and we've done, and he's also written some, peer-reviewed papers about his work, which are great. And we've done some of these, like, lean assessments with some consultants who kind of come in and do exactly what you were describing, where they do this this flow diagram, where they do exactly what you were mentioning, where they basically follow one patient through their journey in the clinic, and they literally clock every step the patient takes and every room they went into and exited and how much time they spent in every spot and so forth. And a lot of the EMRs, you can get really valuable data tracking patients even on a regular day, right? You can see how much time they spend in OCT wait, in OCT and so forth, and kind of develop these patterns. And in the past year in particular, we've been doing all these analysis of these flow diagrams and trying to understand those bottlenecks. And it's hard to generalize, right? They're different for different people's clinics. They're different based on you know, what the ratio is of injections versus new patients versus follow-ups. They actually vary based on the layout of the clinic, the physical layout. You can end up with bottlenecks just because of the way the real estate is designed, particularly if you have a lot of older patients who don't move fast. So it's hard to generalize, but I definitely would encourage people coming out of fellowship and starting a practice, as you say, kind of within the first 6 months to a year, to look at those flow times in the EMR software, if you can. And if not, you can even kind of do them on old-fashioned paper, 1 or 2 days, where you have the patient, you know, go around and the tech marks what time they arrive at each spot along the way, and kind of see, you know, where the bottlenecks are, and then try to work through them. And we've done some good interventions in my practice looking at those bottlenecks and working through them. Most of our interventions have been related to changing the number of staff we have in certain clinics that we're having more bottlenecks, and in the physical layout of clinics. We've actually moved rooms in clinics, the functions of different rooms, in order to address bottlenecks. Like, for example, in one of our clinics, we recently moved, we eliminated like a subway and turned it into an extra OCT room, because we figured out from our flow diagrams that we needed an extra OCT, and it needed to be very close to the, physically close to the front of the clinic to make it efficient. And that helped a lot.
Do you have separate injection rooms, Amy? Or do you have rooms that kind of are multi-purpose for injection techs? Like, is there some redundancy there?
Right. In my practice broadly, all the rooms are multi-purpose. In my clinic specifically, because I have this, distribution of oncology and retina patients, in my busiest mixed clinics, I will designate oftentimes one room as kind of a straight to injection room, so that those routine, monthly injection patients, as Nathan was mentioning, don't kind of get stuck in the tumor bottleneck, and they just kind of go straight into that run room and back out, and that room just keeps flowing with retina patients while the oncology thing is happening almost in parallel. But most of the time in our clinics, all the rooms are multi-purpose, and I think most of my partners feel like it's actually more efficient to keep them that way, so that you can kind of stagger different rooms at different times.
Perfect. You know, Chirag, kind of switching gears, and something that hopefully fellows were exposed to during fellowship, either indirectly via their mentors or maybe they had to do it themselves, but they may not be used to doing it if they were in an academic setting, is communication with referring doctors. Super, super important as a retina specialist in practice. So how do you generally communicate with referring doctors? For example, if you're sending letters, how do you do this so that it doesn't impact your speed in clinic? Or if you had to do a phone call, let's say, or communication, do you save these for later? Do you have a system to kind of keep track of who you need to talk to? Or do you just take care of it along the way and just do it quickly so you don't get hung up?
That's a great question, Jay. At the start of the session, I'll try to send out my letters as I'm going before I get too far behind. Oftentimes for the new patients or the second opinions, I'll wait until the end of the session to send out those letters, because they usually require a little bit more of a personal touch. I work at two different rooms, and I kind of bounce between rooms, and I have scribes. And so my scribes are really superb, and they've saved me a ton of time. And without them, I would be extremely inefficient. But they're pretty good about sending out routine letters just through the electronic medical record. I'll usually write like one or two lines, just sort of a personal note to the referring doctor, just sort of summarizing that Mrs. So-and-so is doing well. And then they'll send out my note, you know, immediately right at that point, and then finalize the note, and then I can just be done and move on to the next room. It's ideal when we can do that for the majority of the patients throughout the day, but invariably there'll be a handful of notes and letters that I need to finish up at the end of the day.
Nathan, do you do something similar?
Yeah, very similar. It sounds almost exactly like me. We're on MDI, and I think the notes are actually pretty good. It's one of the positives of MDIs. I think the referring notes are pretty good, the communication notes. And I try and keep up throughout the day, but if there's a super complex second opinion patient or maybe a medical legal patient that kind of comes through, I save that myself for the end of the day, and I make sure I spend a little bit more time on that note. And then the routine ones, I'll just kind of mention as I leave the room, make sure you send this note to Dr. Johnson and Dr. Smith, and they'll just, you know, in 4 seconds, send that referral note, the update to the referring provider.
Amy, obviously this is much more critical, especially for your subspecialized patients. Again, do you, MDI does generate this like many systems. Do you also sometimes do phone calls? And do you have, again, a system like Chirag or Nathan to keep track of this?
Yeah. So I agree with everything that everyone said. The system breaks down when you have the more complex patients. There's no question that as, you know, I've gotten more senior and the longer and longer I've been in practice, and the more complicated the patients are that I see, the more I have those super complicated patients who like just don't fit into one of the MDI templates. And that really kills your day, because then at the end you're sitting there doing, you know, 10 or 15 new patient notes, all of whom are really complicated. So it's challenging. I don't really have the silver bullet for that, but I think the one tip I would give is to create as many templates as you can. So I have templates. I mean, most of the diseases I see are pretty rare, but I have templates for, you know, a lot of unusual oncologic diagnoses, even though they're all rare, just because anything I can do to save myself time is helpful. So, and then I try to, you know, kind of start with that and work off that template, and that's helpful. And then, as you say, phone calls are really important. I probably make anywhere from 2 to 6 phone calls a day, particularly when I'm dealing with, as you say, kind of like multidisciplinary patients. I'm talking to radiation oncologists and medical oncologists and whatnot. And I try to use these HIPAA-compliant texting systems. I'm getting more and more into that because it's a lot more efficient than phone calls. And I find it's helping. It'd be nice if everybody was on the same system, right? But I have a good number of referring doctors and colleagues these days who are on one of about 3 systems, and I kind of know who's on what system. So I've been trying to do that a lot, and I think that's helpful. I don't know how much experience everyone else has had with those, you know, things like Perfect Serve and, you know, these other apps. You know, they're helpful. They're definitely, you know, Signal and so forth. They're definitely more efficient.
As the least savvy person on this phone call, I have not, but I don't know if Chirag and Nathan have.
You know, I haven't used any of those services. I'll just do regular phone calls. Most of the referring doctors have my cell phone, so we'll just talk quickly either in between patients, and I'll frequently get calls throughout the day, and I'll just take 30 seconds, step out of the room and answer it, because I'll know who's calling, and text. You know, we'll try to text by maybe just using the patient's initials back and forth for particularly for urgent patients. And that seems to be a pretty quick and easy way to do it. And I tend to schedule a lot of my phone calls for my commutes in the evening, typically with patients, but also with referring doctors. And that is a great way to spend, you know, 30 to 60 minutes in the car on the way home, because then you're getting 2 things done at once.
Nathan, I know you do some commuting as well. Is that a useful pearl for you as well?
Yeah, 100% agree with you. The only tricky question I had for Amy too is, you know, I have a hard time then trying to fit that into clinic hours. So Amy, do you have your staff, if you have to track down like an oncologist or a hematologist, do you have your staff try to get a hold of that hematologist and then hold the line for you? Or how do you efficiently do that within working hours?
Yeah, I make the staff do all the legwork. All of it.
Right.
And the challenge is you have to have them do that legwork during clinic, because if you wait until you're done and it's past like business hours, then they can't reach anyone. And for example, with MDI and most of these EMRs, you have to make sure you have the accurate fax number for that doctor. And, you know, a lot of people, like if you just Google their name, you'll get like some random fax number, like through their insurance or something, the insurances they're on, that is actually totally not the accurate fax number. So you really have to, I really have impressed upon my staff that if you are completely committed to that letter getting into that referring doctor's hands, you have to physically pick up the phone, call their office, make sure you're speaking to someone who, you know, is their direct assistant or one of their assistants, and make sure you have the correct fax number, and then enter that into the MDI, you know, new contact bar. And it's critical, because I think this is especially important for fellows coming out, you know, because if you get a very juicy referral from a brand new referring doctor and they never get a fax, they'll probably never send you a patient again. You know, so you have to be very focused on it, and it has to happen during business hours. So the answer is, yeah, I have the staff do all that legwork while I'm still seeing patients. And then at the end of the day, I make sure they've gotten the numbers. They put them into MDI. I finish up the complicated notes, and then we send them off. And I often try to email them too when I can. I don't get them for every single patient every time, but I try. I see a lot of new patients, so I'm always trying to kind of come up with systems for new patients. So it's challenging. It's really challenging. Yeah. Yeah, I think more and more, you know, as our clinics get bigger and bigger, you know, you have to lean on staff to do this stuff. You know, you can't do it all yourself.
I was going to say, I need to upgrade. I'm learning a lot from this conversation. I have book reading from Nathan. I've got apps from Amy that I need to download. And this general life wisdom from Chirag, as usual. So you guys have been exceptionally generous with your time. We've gone a little over, but I'm going to let you guys go. We'll work west to east. I'll start with Nathan. Last piece of thing. So if you had to go back and give bright-eyed, just out of fellowship, Nathan Steinle some advice, Nathan, something you've learned that hasn't been mentioned, something you would have, she had known going back into practice that would have been useful from a logistics, practice building, practice management perspective that you gained over time. Anything else you would offer or want the listeners to know if they're going out to practice this fall?
Yeah, Jay, super good question. So, you know, you spend all the time in fellowship learning surgery, and you learn about the clinical trials, and then you get out in the real world. And it's fascinating. If you actually do your online reviews and you actually look at them and kind of follow them over time, there's really two main things we're judged on. And by far, number one is our wait times. So if you think wait time is kind of not a big issue, no, it's probably the number one thing that patients really can pay attention to. And number two is pain. And so whatever you can do to have, you know, minimize painful injections, painful lasers, painful post-op surgeries, you know, so if you can minimize wait time and minimize pain, you'll be ahead of 98% of the doctors out there. Those would be my two big pearls for people just coming out of fellowship.
Amy, how about you?
So I think that with respect to relationships with referring doctors, there's two major things that you can do to kind of build relationships with those doctors and in turn, can, you know, referral numbers. One is, and this is going to sound kind of obvious, but is to just be patient. Because what happens, I think, when you enter a new community and you're there for years over time is that the reality is that referrals grow organically over time. As you provide good care to patients, and then those patients go back to their referring doctor and say, hey, you know, Dr. So-and-so was great, and, you know, that person figured out what I had, no one else did, or, you know, that person was just really compassionate or really went the extra mile or whatnot. It just kind of grows organically over time. Some of it is you just have to put time in. Like, the more years go by, the more kind of people's names build in the community and stuff just comes. So part of it is just patience. And the other is just kind of all the old fashioned, you know, all the A's, right? Affable, available, and I forgot the third one, but
it's being awesome.
Ability.
Ability, right. So, you know, just being available, right? Pick up the phone when the referring doctor texts you, always say yes when they want to add an extra patient. All these issues that we already discussed. You know, just being available and trying to be communicative with referring doctors.
And Chirag, as the senior statesman, I'll let you close.
I can't believe I'm the senior person on this call. I completely agree with everything that Nathan and Amy have said, and I've certainly learned on this call. I think a couple of things that I've thought about and have tried to teach my fellows is, one is always say yes. And so if someone needs to ask on a patient that Friday at 6 o'clock, just say yes. If a patient wants you to print out their OCTs or your staff to print out their OCTs for the last year, just say yes. Like, whatever, you know, whatever it is, like, just always say yes. And remember that we're here to serve our patients. Sometimes I think that can be lost and kind of time. And I think one of perhaps some important thing that has to do with something that you maybe indirectly does, has to do with just wellness for the doctor. And I think sometimes it's easy to forget, especially when we're bright and bushy-tailed right out of fellowship. We've just sprinted through residency. We've just sprinted through fellowship. And then all of a sudden, we've gone from sprinting to an ultra marathon. And we have to remember we can't keep sprinting. And in the beginning, we want to sprint and get busy and keep doing a lot of surgery, did dream fellowship and see a lot of patients, but it will definitely get busier and busier and busier for everyone until therapy takes our infections away, but that's a different story. The important thing is to develop a wellness plan early, preferably before fellowship, but at the latest fellowship or when you start as an attendant. Develop a wellness plan, and whatever that might be for the individual. It might be doing yoga, which is a great thing to do to push your core as an ophthalmologist who typically gets back pain, or doing exercise, or just having time to read. But I'd make sure that you have balance in your life, and try not to lose that balance, because I find that, you know, if you're seeing 80 patients a day, unless you're super like Nathan is, and I'm not that efficient, that kind of leads into your personal time and your family time and your wellness time. So I guess that's the advice that I would probably end with, is that the better you take care of yourself and the better balance you have in your own life, the better you then take care of your patients. And remember, it's an ultra marathon. Your body, your mind, your hands, your eyes have to last for 3 years throughout your career, not just to your health.
That is great advice. And guys, thank you so much for staying up late, coast to coast. Dr. Amy Scheffler, Dr. Chirag Shah, and Dr. Nathan Steinle, thank you all for your time. It was, I'm sure, greatly appreciated by the fellows.
Thank you, Jay,
for having us. Thank you so much, Jay.
Thanks, Nathan. Yeah. Thanks, Amy.
Have a great night.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Thank you.
Bye-bye. As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. We have 181 episodes up there. Yes, 181, and they are sorted by category for your easy searching. You will also find our blog on the website with commentaries on many of the episodes. Remember, you can claim CME credits for select podcasts via the AAO website. You need to be a member of the AAO, and you can log in and visit the link in the episode description and claim credits. Remember, on our website, the best way to keep track of its episodes as they release is if you sign up for our mailing list, then you'll get updates on the most recent episodes. At the bottom are links to subscribe in the Apple Podcast Store, as well as the Android Store. We have a Facebook page, or you can find us in the Apple Podcast Store or the Android Store directly. Remember, we are on Twitter at Retina Podcast, and to contact us, click on the contest link on our website or email us directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com. We love feedback, both on things we can do better and things we are already doing well. Again, we love people who leave reviews in the Apple Store, Android Store. That really helps us in terms of feedback and to continue doing what we're doing. Many thanks to Dr. Scheffler, Dr. Shah, and Dr. Steinle for joining me. Thanks to Dr. Louis Kai, Dr. Angela Chang, and Dr. Michael Benincasa for preparing this episode. Listeners, thank you for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire here. I look forward to seeing many of you at the ASRS meeting this weekend. We will have our next episode release on Monday, July 29, 2019. This is Jay Schreeder signing off.
Good feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.
Take care. Bye-bye.